This is The Full Story. I'm Tom Kuser. The Emergency Medical Service, or EMS, as most of us know it, is a public service that, you know, we kind of don't think about until we need it. When we dial 911, we trust that trained medical professionals will arrive to help. In Connecticut, there's a mixed bag of systems in place to make sure that help will be on the way when the call comes in. Today, we'll explore the emergency medical service in Connecticut and New York and how the system can vary from town to town and why that came to be. Steve Rambone is an EMT and a trainer of EMTs, and for the past four decades, he's worked as an EMT in Connecticut and New York. And Mr. Rambone joins us on Zoom. Welcome to The Full Story.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
When did you decide to become an EMT?
I was a senior in high school, and a friend of mine and I decided that we were going to do some work at a local ambulance corps. They needed some, you know, odd jobs done. And so I did, and we did some odd jobs, and somebody there talked me into it. Now, that was 1976, and so when I went to college in 1977, I became an EMT.
Before we go on and get into some specifics about how it's structured, maybe we need a definition of what EMS actually is and the service it provides. I think we all believe we know what that is, but I think it would be instructive to really get a good picture of what it is and the services that an EMT brings to the table when we call 911.
EMT, of course, stands for Emergency Medical Technician, and it's a name that came up in probably the mid-early 70s. Starting back, I don't know how far back you want to go, but let's go back to the 1940s and 50s.
I was going to say, I'd like to go back as far as we need to really understand how it evolved, but go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, sure. So the earliest EMS systems in this country came out of the Civil War.
And, oh, wow.
Yeah, because what was happening was they would, after the battles took place, the officers waited until the complete battle is over, maybe a day or two, and then send in wagons to pick up people. And of course, as you can imagine, that was a complete waste of personnel. So around the Battle of Antietam, which they had thousands and thousands of casualties, it was decided they send in the ambulance corps, which was these wagons and somewhat trained personnel right away. And they would take these people off the battlefield and they would treat them. Now, of course, that was the Civil War era. So, you know, you can imagine how rough that was.
So but someone decided at that point, as opposed to put it bluntly, picking bodies up off the battlefield, there would be an attempt to actually save some of the wounded soldiers by going into the field as soon as possible after the battle had ended.
Correct. Correct. Mm. They decided, you know, why wait? Let's get in there. Now, of course, there was a danger to the ambulance personnel, and a lot of them were killed trying to pick bodies up or injured soldiers in the middle of this battle, but they did. And they realized they could save a lot of people that way. And of course, that was then quickly get them back, bandage it up, and get them back to fight again another day. And then for years after that, they realized we need trained personnel in this country. And throughout the early 1900s, 1930s and 40s, most of the ambulance services were run by funeral homes because they had hearses and you can put somebody in a vertical, you know, supine position. And so they had like contracts in most of the towns and cities that if somebody was hurt, they would call the funeral home and they'd throw them in the back and both guys would jump in the front seat and drive the person to either the doctor's office or the hospital. Of course, that proved not to be a great system because these people that were throwing these people in the back of this hearse or so-called ambulance, they called it at the time, they were not trained. And so in the 1950s and into the 1960s, they realized we need more training. When the Vietnam War was ending, a lot of the corpsmen came back and medics from Vietnam, and a lot of them were highly trained. And this was, well, as you know, the Paris Peace Accords was signed in 73, which is very interesting because in 1973, that happens to be the year that the National EMS Systems Act was signed by Congress. And since 1973, the term EMT came about, and these were trained people. Now, in Connecticut, I forgot the exact amount of time. I think it was like 82-hour class or 81-hour. Now it's 150-hour for an EMT. It's a lot longer for a paramedic. But so the EMT started nationwide in 1973, the actual term. And in 1975, the first paramedics were trained in Connecticut.
So an EMT is not necessarily a paramedic.
No, a paramedic has a lot more training, a lot more hours in classroom. What the paramedic can do that the EMT cannot do is the paramedic can give medications. They can, which is, of course, key, they can intubate a patient, they can give IVs, and they can monitor with these very expensive machines called, you know, life packs or cardiac monitors. And so that's what the paramedics can do. So about half in Connecticut, about half the calls are what they call paramedic level or ALS, and about the other half are basic life support, which is EMT level ambulance calls.
And the determination as to who will go to a call is decided by the dispatcher or whoever is picking up the 911 call?
Correct. It varies by town by town. As you started in your introduction, there is a hodgepodge of systems in Connecticut. Unlike out in the West Coast, for example, it's county system. But here in Connecticut, we have our little fiefdoms. So it's town by town. And each town has their own way of doing things. In the larger cities, most of them, the three largest cities, are all commercially based ambulance systems. In the smaller cities, it can be municipal, run by the hospital or something like that. But what happens is, depending on the algorithm that the dispatcher gets, they have a computer system. And when the 911 caller calls in and determines or tells what the situation is, by following the algorithm, it's like a little flow chart that you actually read. They will determine whether the ambulance call is paramedic needed or just a basic life support. Now, in some towns like Danbury or in Norwalk or something like that, no matter who calls, if you have for stub toe or you call for, you know, a heart attack, you will get a paramedic with an EMT.
Let's talk a little bit more about the, as you phrased it, the hodgepodge of approaches to the EMS system in Connecticut. It's interesting that there's a national bill that was signed 50 years ago to put such a system in place. I'm assuming that the states get to decide exactly how their own systems work, thus California having something more homogeneous from town to town, in Connecticut, where a home rule is common, maybe notorious, and each system, each town has a different system. Could you talk a little bit more about how that works and what the different systems are? You mentioned commercial, you mentioned municipally controlled. I understand some systems have volunteers involved.
Mm-hmm. I'm a member right now of a volunteer ambulance corps. I'm a member of Newtown Ambulance in the western part of the state. I've been a member there 30 years, but I've been involved in EMS for a long time. Like I said, in 77, I became an EMT. And straight off, I started working commercial, and that's what we call it now. I work for, in the city of Hartford, I work for an ambulance company called Professional Ambulance Service, which has since been bought out by AMR, which is AMR. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've seen those ambulances around.
Sure.
That's the largest ambulance company in the country. It's a privately, you know, it's a commercially operated ambulance system. So what happened is, as they say, Connecticut is land of, you know, steady habits, and people don't like to give up their little, as I mentioned, little fiefdoms. Mm-hmm. So what happens is, in the smaller towns, a lot of times politics gets involved. Sometimes the ambulance services were run by the fire departments, which had a lot of political pull in towns. And so they don't want to give up their control of their call volume or what have you. When I started to work in EMS in Connecticut, like I said, in 1977, matter of fact, my uniform for professional ambulance said, medical technician on it, because they were just barely coming out with the term EMT. So even my uniform was different than it is today. And so I worked in this commercial system in Hartford, but you go directly to, I don't know, town south of Wethersfield, or if you went to Bloomfield, they would have their own little volunteer ambulance system. Now, of course, over time, that's changed. But, you know, every town had that wanted to have their own control, whether it was the mayor or the first selectman or whoever.
But from town to town, regardless of the system, the trained technicians, the EMTs, must measure up to the same training standards, I would assume, regardless of whether they're volunteer or commercial?
Correct. Every EMT in the state of Connecticut, and the same thing with the paramedic, has to pass standards, and they have to take a certain amount of hours of class and take a written test and a practical test, so hands-on training is done. Plus, you have to have hours in the field before you can actually go out and become an EMT. So whether you work in a small little town in Connecticut or we work in the big city in Connecticut, an EMT is still the same standard. They have to take the same level of training no matter what town they're in. And the same thing with the paramedics.
Who at the state level oversees the EMS system in Connecticut?
Okay, it's actually well done. It's done by the OEMS, which is the Office of Emergency Medical Services. There in Hartford, it's well run. It's a system that, considering that they have to deal with all these little, small little ambulance service or a fire department ambulance, or a large city or a large commercial operation like AMR or something like that, but they keep control and they have protocols which are followed by every ambulance service, EMT, and paramedic.
Does between having the state level oversight and consistent standards for EMTs across the state, does that sort of mitigate the possible confusion that the hodgepodge of systems could bring into the mix?
Yeah, absolutely. Because the protocols are the same depending on whether you're in, I don't know, I'm just going to Simsbury as opposed to you're in Old Lyme. It's the same state protocols. Now, what may change a little bit is a lot of the ambulance systems work under medical control of a local hospital. So they may have some small changes in the regulations, but pretty much we all follow the state regulations of OEMS. It's called the protocols.
Do you foresee, or should the state even bother trying to step in and create sort of a statewide standard like California, you mentioned? I can't imagine that's in the offing, given, again, home rule, which is pretty much the rule in Connecticut. But is that something you could foresee happening down the road?
I think so. Well, what they have now, and this is, I'd say, probably as far as EMT training, since I think the mid-late 90s, I'm not sure the exact date, the National Registry of EMTs is a national standard that Connecticut now follows, so that every EMT in Connecticut to become an EMT has to take this national registry test. So it's kind of a national system as far as testing. But what we don't have in Connecticut is pretty much countywide systems. And it seems to me it would make sense because you would have small towns right next to each other buying expensive pieces of equipment with low call volume. And yet, you know, we have fully equipped ambulances sitting in one town, just sitting around doing nothing. And while the town next to it could use their help. Now there is a system called mutual aid, which is used, but I think in the long run, it'd be a better system if we work on more of a county system so that when an ambulance call goes out, you know, it doesn't matter if it's in, I don't know, Brookfield, Connecticut, or whether it's in Roxbury, you know, the ambulance would go, whoever's available and whoever's has the crew ready would respond. But right now, you know, it's a delay in time. They call one ambulance service, and then if they can't get somebody, then they call the next town. And so it is a delayed system. It could use improvement.
You mentioned county governments or county systems, and you've worked in New York, as I understand, in New York State,
yes.
Where county government is the lay of the land. That's the way things are done in New York. Could you talk a bit about the system in New York? Is it as varied as the Connecticut system or more standardized from county to county?
No, it's about the same thing. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not pushing for a county system in Connecticut.
Yeah.
You talk about, you know, additional taxes and everything else. It just adds levels of bureaucracy onto things. I don't think we need it in Connecticut. I think the system works pretty well as far as the government. But as far as county-wise, in Connecticut, in New York, yes, they still have counties. And depending on certain counties, for example, Nassau County runs its own ambulance service out in Long Island, where in Westchester, where I worked also as a volunteer EMT for 40 some years, the system there works on town to town, similar to Connecticut. New York doesn't, they're not the same as far as the national registry. It's optional. Now they're changing. You can become a national registry EMT, but it's kind of has, they have more control in the state of New York, but the protocols are almost exactly the same. If you look at the Connecticut protocols for an EMT and the same thing for a paramedic and this, and you put them against the Connecticut ones, they're very similar.
What do most people use EMS for today, would you say? Any way of telling?
That's a tricky question. It depends on the town and the city. And this is where it gets complicated, especially when it comes to the cost of medical care. And this, of course, is the big debate now. Many times in the urban towns, Hartford, New Haven, Bridgeport, or any of the urban towns, some people use the ambulance service for a stuffy nose or a cough because that is their medical care. And they get taken to the ER and they go sit out in the lobby for, you know, X amount of time. And they're finally seen because that is who they use for their medical care. And since they don't have transportation, they call the ambulance. Now, not all the calls are that, but a lot of them are. I was talking to somebody that worked in EMS in Norway, for example. And there they said the EMS crew comes to the scene and decides right then and there whether the person should go to the hospital or see their own doctor, like Monday morning type of thing. They have the power to do that and say, hey, you know, you don't really need to go to the hospital. Just stay here and call your own doctor or whatever in a day or two. In our country, especially in Connecticut, and same thing in New York, the minute you call 911, we have to go and we have to take people if they want to go. We don't decide whether, you don't have to go. We can't say that. If they want to go to the hospital, we take them to the hospital. In the urban areas, a lot of the calls, it's a mix. It's a lot of minor things. And then of course you have, some major injuries, stabbings and heart attacks, things like that. In the more suburban areas, it's generally people need the ambulance, they'll call the ambulance. Although we have people there that abuse EMS systems in every town, no matter where you are.
My colleague here on The Full Story, our senior producer, Ann Lopez, has a brother who was an EMT in New York City. And okay. He said that he would often get calls from people who were lonely. That's yeah. why they called 911. Yeah. And it sounds like you've had that experience or similar experiences as well.
I had an ambulance call. I don't want to tell any war stories, but just a year ago, where they called the ambulance and they wanted us to come and defrost their ham for them. and because they had no, there was an elderly person, they had nobody to take it out of the freezer. And they called 911 because to them that was an emergency, because if they didn't get their ham out of the freezer, they would not be able to eat that night. So they called 911 and we said to them, this is really for emergency purposes. And to this person, they were convinced that this was an emergency. You know, I wouldn't be able to eat. My ham wasn't defrosted. So, it's crazy what we see.
What's it been like operating as an EMT? Well, the EMS system generally, what's it been like during the pandemic?
Yeah, the very beginning of the pandemic, because I'm no young guy myself and I have an asthma condition, I backed off for about 2 months back in March and April. Even having done that, I felt guilty that while I was backing off, other people, a lot of our younger members, were stepping up. But even having said that, then I came back and I've been doing ambulance calls ever since, and we've certainly taken a lot of COVID patients. But I really give credit to the EMS system, the unsung heroes, that throughout this whole coronavirus pandemic have been there. Anytime someone calls 911, they're there picking somebody up and bringing them to the hospital and putting themselves at risk. And we have an excellent group of EMTs and paramedics in the state of Connecticut. And I'm proud of every one of them, no matter what town they work in or what ambulance service they work for. they worked right through this pandemic. And the same thing you saw in New York City, you saw in the news, you know, these paramedics and EMTs would be taking people and just having them wait outside in the ER. I mean, it was just very difficult situation, but, you know, hopefully we're coming through it. And then, you know, who knows what's going on right now, but if you take special precautions and you wear the proper PPE, you know, we should be safe.
As a trainer, what sort of questions have you been hit with during the pandemic from EMTs or from towns that want to make sure that they are responding in a proper way to make sure not only themselves, but their patients are safe in terms of the pandemic and of COVID?
That's a great question. I've been running EMT instructor for in our town. And when it first broke, we had a class, we went to Zoom. And then after that, the next class, I had a bunch of people concerned about taking the class. And I said, EMT class in person. We're not going to do any more Zoom EMT class because a lot of it has to be hands-on. So in Mike's situation, it happened to be fall of that next year, we actually set up tents outside our building and ran the class outside. And it worked great. The weather's beautiful. We had tents and, you know, the PowerPoints were going outside and all that. But we had a number of people who originally signed up or then canceled out for fear of COVID. And then we had people that joined, and even in spite of the middle of COVID, they were taking this class. And as I told people, you have in the EMT class, you have to do a ride along. You have to ride on the ambulances. And I said, in the very beginning, I said, listen, somebody has to do this. I mean, somebody has to go and take these sick people to the hospital. If this is something you don't want to do, perhaps this is not for you. But, you know, it's a job that has to be done. And so, yes, there was some concern, but with proper PPE and, you know, policy set up, we worked it out.
There have been a couple of stories I've heard from out west. I think one was in Montana, one from Utah, where there were problems retaining or recruiting people to be EMTs. I believe the Montana story, there were situations where there were no response to some calls because the volunteer system there was so depleted. The other story out of Utah, I believe, had to do with the amount of money that EMTs were being paid in a system there. One EMT said, essentially, I get paid $2 more per hour than my babysitter, so I'm working to pay my babysitter. I'm wondering if you're seeing any issues, especially during the pandemic, in people volunteering or deciding to turn this into a career.
Yes, absolutely. Now, again, right now in my stage of my career, I do not work on a commercial ambulance, work on a volunteer ambulance. So I don't really know what the HR departments of the large systems are, but have talking to colleagues that work in those, they had a hard time getting people to work. And a lot of people just weren't becoming EMTs or decided not to do it, or for whatever health reason or family members, they decided not to work EMS, whether EMT or paramedic. So that left an incredible burden on the existing people that had to work. They had to work double, triple shifts and put in a lot of hours to fill the void. So yeah, it's definitely been a problem. The other issue which you mentioned, of course, is pay. EMTs and paramedics have always been a low pay job, which is a shame. Unfortunately, you know, the police and the fire department get all sorts of credit and usually some decent pay for what they do. And yet the EMTs and paramedics have to go into some really ugly situations for low pay. When I started in Hartford, I was actually risking my life working in the city of Hartford for $3.35 an hour. That was, you know, minimum wage at the time. It's not much higher now. I mean, it is minimum, but plus, you know, a little bit more, which is a shame. These people are highly trained. They work very hard and are dedicated, and yet they're just not paid like they should be.
That sort of begs the question, where does the system need to go from here? I'm guessing a better pay grade would help, but generally speaking, where does the system need to evolve, or how does the system need to evolve, do you think, from this point?
Well, I want to tell you, I'm not an expert on finding the answers for this. This is a very complicated issue. Mm. You know, some people have said over the years, oh, if they were unionized, it would be a lot higher pay. Although there are EM systems that are unionized, and they're still complaining about the pay. I just think it has to be on a state-by-state basis that politicians have to realize this is an important job and the pay must be increased.
Mr. Rambone, thanks so much for your insights about the EMS system and how EMTs work on the job. We appreciate your contribution today.
Anytime. Thank you very much.
Steve Rambone is an EMT and a trainer of EMTs as well. Along Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford, Connecticut, is a memorial to lives lost during the 9/11 attack on the World Trade Center. Each day, dozens of cars pass it by. But do most drivers notice it? The memorial sits on a patch of grass on the quiet side of Fire and Rescue Station Number 7. And that's where I met up with Milford Battalion Chief Christopher Zack.
It is a piece of structural steel that came from one of the Trade Center towers in New York City. We were fortunate enough and honored to be able to get it after the recovery process.
It's not very big, between 5 and 6 feet long. It looks something like an inverted L, a bent piece of steel that could have been a structural girder from one of the buildings. It's a rusty dark brown color with large rivets down one side, and bits of concrete are still lodged between the rivets. It's mounted on a short pole, and at the base of the pole is a plaque surrounded by yellow and orange marigolds. I asked Chief Zack how a piece of steel from the World Trade Center found a home outside a fire station in Milford.
Well, one of the things that we wanted to really focus on with this piece was, you know, the loss. The New York City Fire Department suffered 343 deaths from their firefighters. Those individuals were heroes. They went into the buildings as everybody was going out. You know, after the first tower fell, they still continued to go in and tried to do rescues. So us in the fire service, approximately every year, about 100 firefighters die in the line of duty. You know, in 2001, that was 343 plus. So every year we hold memorials. We remember those individuals that passed, and we try to learn from them of, you know, maybe their character or maybe their certain actions or what happened at those fires. We put this monument here to go along with the deceased firefighters that have worked in the Milford Fire Department, because we always want to remember those individuals and pay our tribute. It's going to be an interesting day on Saturday to do all this remembrance.
I understand there also were three residents of Milford who were in the towers that day who died.
Yes, they're memorialized at the memorial site down by City Hall, and I believe also at Live Oak School. There's a couple more memorials there too.
What do you think it means to the firefighters in Station 7 and elsewhere in the city, many of whom are, I've seen them, fairly young people, men and women? What do you think it means to them to have this actual piece of steel from the World Trade Center?
Well, what I hope it means to them is they, every time those individuals go out the door, you know, Engine 7 and Medic 3 are at this firehouse. Every time they go out the door, and it's more than 9,000 times a year that the Milford Fire Department responds to emergency responses, those individuals look at the memorial and say, you know, we don't know what we're going to. And oftentimes, you know, they're faced in situations and, you know, they may not come back. So I hope that as they move out, they look at those individuals and, you know, remember some names, remember some faces, remember some actions, and do the best that they can based on their experience and training to hopefully successfully come back home and then leave at the end of their shift.
I wonder how aware community members are about this memorial. I see a couple of what are at this point tattered small American flags placed in it. Do people leave mementos, items here from time to time?
Occasionally they do. We had a few people come in and knock on the firehouse door and say, hey, can we take some pictures? Absolutely, absolutely. That's what we want to be able to do. You know, it's not a constant flow, but it is a small flow of gifts and thoughts and processes that go on where people are stopping by.
What does it mean to you personally to have this piece of World Trade Center steel essentially memorialized here?
Yeah, I'm honored. I'm honored by the whole process. Assistant Chief Robert Healy and firefighter Dave King were instrumental in getting this, along with some other individuals that, you know, went down to New York City and got the piece. You know, what it means to me, you know, I lost a few friends that were down there in New York City. We'll remember, you know, individuals like Terry Hatton and stuff like that. It's going to bring back a lot of memories and a lot of good memories, but we definitely want to memorialize them.
Why is it important to remember 9/11?
It definitely changed our country. You know, I remember the days after, you know, everybody waving flags, everybody saying they were proud to be an American. You just look at now the situation, you know, we just ended, you know, it's been 20 years. We have to unite as a country. We have to unite as a human race. You know, we have to be kind to one another. And I think, hopefully, we look at this situation and we see how we came together as a country, a human race, and everybody was together for a short period of time, and we're starting to separate now from that. We need to get back.
How did it change for you as a first responder, as a firefighter, first responders generally, after 9/11?
After 9/11, there was a lot of unknowns. You know, we were wondering what was going to be next. We saw an increase in hazardous materials types calls with white powder, you know, of, you know, the anthrax threat that was there. We still do train a lot with terrorism. We've gotten a lot of equipment, a lot of money. The fire department has a hazardous materials team. So we're ready to go. But, you know, after 9/11, it was a lot of, you know, what is going to happen next? What can we be prepared for? Trying to determine what we didn't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, Battalion Chief Christopher Zack, thanks for your time today. We appreciate your insights and reflections on 9/11 and the World Trade Center Memorial that's at Firehouse Number 7 in Milford, Connecticut.
My pleasure.
Thank you. How do people remember transformative historical events? The 9/11 attacks happened two decades ago. But do we as a nation remember that day the same way now as we did in 2010 or 2001 for that matter? And will younger generations carry the significance of that day into the future, or will the memory of that day fade with time? To help us understand what happens to the collective memory of a key historic event, we've invited Professor Jill Fellison to join us today. She's a professor of history and interdisciplinary studies at Quinnipiac University in Hamden, Connecticut. And she joins us now via Zoom. Professor Fellison, welcome to The Full Story.
Thank you, Tom.
First of all, maybe we should define a historic event. What defines an historic event?
Well, I think part of that, the great majority of that really is the fact that historians, in going back through the records, decide what is important. And it also is, you know, luck of the draw, what documents survive, what evidence survives. So, you know, our narratives of the past are constructed. And to a large extent, historians and other scholars decide what is important and what we remember. And, you know, major events, as you said, like Pearl Harbor or 9/11, because of the collective experience, are much more likely to be remembered collectively rather than some other events.
So there certainly could be events that maybe aren't that well documented that could qualify as historic events had there been paperwork or something more than oral history to save the information.
Certainly, yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, is history viewed differently, would you say, by those who are much closer to where the event occurred? I'm talking, you know, geographically closer, you know, Pearl Harbor, maybe battles of the Civil War, Revolutionary War.
I think place does have a very powerful aspect to our memory, that if you are near the place, you know, you do remember it. I think there's a difference between memory and history. I think to truly become history, there has to be some sort of historical break that we can have some perspective to look back on it and analyze it. So I think we're sort of just getting to the point, perhaps, with 9/11, that it is becoming a historical event rather than a living event. Because we now, you know, college students, the majority of college students now have no direct memories of 9/11.
So then what happens to the impact of the events when it becomes a piece of history as opposed to a piece of memory?
I think then we have, you know, the ability to critically analyze it, to look at it with perhaps, not impartial, but less passion, less personal experience. And I think that we get a better perspective. We get a broader perspective. It's if we, you know, for those of it that do remember 9/11 very vividly, the trauma really of the first months and years afterwards, you know, hits those who remember it, who are close to it, much more, and probably still, and certainly still impacts those today. Whereas if we teach it in, you know, high schools or our colleges, we can put it in its broader perspective, within global history, within international relations, and all of those aspects, to sort of make it a more, you know, complicated narrative.
Certainly with 9/11 in our region, with so many people affected by it directly, or perhaps just one or two steps away from directly, the health aspects of the first responders, for example, the mental health effect on so many people who were either there or close to it, lived in the city perhaps, that really makes it something that's still happening, doesn't it, as opposed to something that happened 20 years ago?
Yes, I agree. And I think that, you know, for some, it isn't history. They're still living it. If you were, a child who lost a parent, you're certainly still living and coping with it every day. But I think for the many Americans, you know, they really probably remember it, you know, one day a year. Perhaps this year, it is a little bit different in the fact that we are, you know, coming up on the 20th anniversary of 9/11, but also of the military actions in Afghanistan. So I think this year is unique in a number of ways.
Is it important how we remember events like this?
I think so. I think it's incredibly important to fully contextualize it. History's messy. You know, I always tell my students that there's very little black and white, that most things are pretty gray and messy. And for me, that makes history more fascinating. But that it is important, I think, now that we start to put it into some sort of historical context of the larger events of our nation and also, you know, our nation's involvement at the global level.
And why is that important?
It tells the story of us. I mean, history is sort of tells the story of what makes us human. And I think that, as a nation, understanding our history, the good and the bad, you know, makes us, you know, more empathetic people. I think history is incredibly important for understanding empathy, for putting ourselves in many different people's shoes, not just those of Americans, but other people around the world during, the early 2000s.
Do you think we're more likely to learn from what's happened in the past if we remember it in the way that you described?
I think so. I think that I don't believe history repeats itself. I think there are patterns and tendencies that, you know, human nature that we tend to fall into. And I think the more we understand about our past and where we get to places that, you know, perhaps we have a better understanding. If we listen to history, then we have a better perspective of our present.
You mentioned before about students, college students at this point, who were not alive when 9/11 occurred 20 years ago, and that it's more of a piece of history for many of them. Do you find that your students care about the past, even if it is part of a history lesson, as opposed to something they experienced themselves?
I think so. I mean, I think there are ways to get students excited about the past. As I said, I teach history as, you know, messy and I think students, you know, I think any period of history, it can be interesting. And if it's more than just, you know, names and dates, but that you give them the full context, that you give them a perspective of the people, of personal experiences. I find, you know, individual experiences are really effective in helping students, you know, empathize and really understand a period of history.
I'd like to ask you in a few moments about the immersive learning tool that you use called Reacting to the Past with your students. But I'm wondering, too, with the internet and social media, does the younger generation engage with history differently than previous generations?
I think so. I think you do have to recognize that these students do learn differently, that they are used to learning things in short snippets, that they sort of, you know, bring in information in different ways than perhaps we did, rather than, you know, sitting for hours reading a book. They may, you know, surf through various social media sites. So, and while I don't think, you know, you can completely, you know, throw out textbooks or readings, I think you do have to change how you present readings, and that you can still, you know, you can still spark that interest. But I think it's different. I think you have to spark it in different ways. I've been teaching over 20 years, and I certainly teach differently now than I did, you know, 20 years ago.
Do you find in engaging with students today, you've got to deal with more, especially information that comes from social sites or really anywhere on the internet, disinformation or misinformation?
I certainly make students aware of it. That I also remind them that there's been, you know, disinformation for a long time. And I give them examples from, you know, the 17th century, for example, of disinformation and propaganda, and that, you know, help them understand in historical context that this isn't new, that it may be in greater number now because of social media. But I think one of the things history can teach is to be very critical and to be a critical reader, and to, you know, to develop historical thinking, that you do develop that critical eye.
Are there historical events, specific events that stand out for your students? Do you find any kind of a theme or trend?
I mean, I think as far as, you know, recent history, 20th century, I think the Holocaust is certainly one of those things that they learn about in schools as a separate event. And so I think that is something that they will pull out from a grander narrative. So I think those types of events, and it remains to be seen if 9/11 is that way. Is it one of those events that we always remember almost separately from the larger context? Because I think the Holocaust, we often look at even beyond World War II.
An issue that seems to have organized the younger generation, current issue connected with history, is the removal of Confederate statues and remembrances of the Confederacy. Mm-hmm. The perspective of the nation and how we're choosing to remember our history seems to have changed, and it is causing some tension. When we remove statues, are we wiping away a part of history, or are we setting the record straight? And I'm wondering, how do you think students are looking at that?
I think some of it depends on the origin of the statue. Many of the statues that have been removed were actually, you know, not necessarily, they were done later, perhaps in the 20th century. I think there is a place for these statues. I don't think a public place that, because the reality is for many people, these statues do represent the legacy of slavery. And so perhaps they should be in a museum where they can be fully contextualized, because I think as a monument in the center of a town, they aren't contextualized necessarily.
Tell us about this approach that you use to teaching history, an immersive learning tool called Reacting to the Past. How do you apply this method, and how does it work?
It's sort of an innovative pedagogy that actually originated at Barnard College and has spread, you know, throughout history and general education in the United States and elsewhere. And it is these immersive role-playing games where students take on roles, they are given roles to play, and you play out a pivotal event in history. And the students, you know, really inhabit, they cross into the threshold of the classroom, and they're really to leave behind their identity and become these characters. Many of them are historical figures, and they do research and they develop the characters, and then, you know, they read documents, and then we play these out within the classroom.
Do they take to this method? I would think some students maybe aren't that comfortable speaking in front of a class, never mind sort of acting a part in a historical event.
I think it takes a lot of trust and a leap of faith, and it's something I work very hard on in a class is to sort of allow it to become the space where students will participate. I've had very good luck with it. I have, you know, students follow me through classes because they know I play games. And I think, you know, if you can kind of get into that, the idea is that students love to play role-playing games online with, you know, they have been doing that for years. Mm. And if you can convince them that this is sort of a variation on the video games they play, then they're often willing to take the leap with you. And so I've had very good luck with them. And students will surprise you. Students who are afraid to talk as themselves, once they can take on a persona, actually develop a confidence that I may not have seen previously. And I think the games are really a safe place to work out tricky issues. One game I use, we look at religious tolerance in the 16th century, but it also has universal themes of tolerance. And so it's a safe place for students to sort of deal with these issues rather than in our modern day where it can be messier and more emotional.
Have you used this method to teach about what happened on 9/11?
I have not used it for 9/11. I have used it for other, pivotal moments. I've used it. I use one game. I teach a colonial Latin America class. And so I actually use one on the meeting of Cortez and Montezuma. And so we have, that momentous occasion that certainly changed, the Americas in dramatic ways. So I have not done 9/11. But there are many contemporary 20th century games that faculty do use.
I think you've mentioned that there came a point in your teaching career where you wanted your students to take away something other than dates and names, those kinds of things from your classes. Does reacting to the past, does that method achieve that, do you think?
I think it does. I think that when it is, when the students buy into it, I think they do take on a different perspective. They understand that history, one of the great things I think reacting helps with is that history isn't, of course it turned out that way. When you work through a momentous event, you see, mistakes or particular decisions that were made that if they'd gone in a different direction, history would have gone in a different direction. And so it's not counterfactual necessarily, but students do understand that things don't necessarily have to have turned out the way they did, if not for the decisions of people or luck or, environment, and all of these factors, play a role in what happened in the past.
What inspired you to become a history professor?
I always loved the past. I always, I was always a little bit of an escapist. I loved to read and always wanted to study history. I actually started my career in business. I was actually an accountant, but had always loved history and ended up going back and getting a PhD. And so for me, it really was the story. And so I think that's why I try to make history an exciting story, because I think it is, because it always was for me.
How do you think 9/11 will be remembered 20 years from now?
I mean, it's hard to predict. I think it will be remembered as the time when Americans, for us, terrorism, I think, in many ways had been something that happened elsewhere. And I think it has changed our mindset that we are more connected to these, to events around the world. And I think that for me, if I'm to predict, that it was the time that we understood the personal experience of terrorism.
Professor, thanks for sharing your insights and opinions about history and the way it's taught and about the future of remembering 9/11. We appreciate your time today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Jill Fellison is a professor of history and interdisciplinary studies at Quinnipiac University in Hamden, Connecticut. How do you remember September 11th, 2001? Let us know. You can email us at tfs@wshu.org. And we're on Twitter at FullStoryWSHU. That's it for our program today, produced by Fatou Sangare and senior producer Ann Lopez. I'm Tom Kuser. Thank you for listening to The Full Story.